Jay is Minister of Foreign Affairs. This is a great point gained in favor of our country. Wisdom and virtue have triumphed for once, and I hope and believe he will give an entire new cast to the complexion of our foreign affairs. That's James Warren writing in a letter, June 30th, 1784, to John Adams about John Jay, whom we might call the forgotten founder. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
Why was Jay a reluctant rebel when the American Revolution broke out? What were his goals as a peace commissioner at the end of the Revolution? What precedents did he set as Chief Justice, and why was he burned in effigy? Our guest is John Kaminsky, author of various books on the Founding Fathers and director and founder of the Center for the Study of the American Constitution at the UW-Madison.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Good to be back.
You know, usually when we're talking about someone like John Adams or Madison or Thomas Jefferson, there's no problem of name recognition or just general understanding. But John Jay is, as Norman mentioned, sort of the forgotten founder. Why do you think that is?
It's hard to say. If you had to select, say, five of the most important individuals from the American Revolutionary era, and what I mean by that is from the beginning to the end of the era, so that Madison and Hamilton would not apply because they were too young. But people would select four very quickly, and that would be Jefferson, Washington, naturally, Adams, and Franklin. But the fifth that they would probably never select would be John Jay. He is not considered among the others because he was, first of all, never president, so he didn't get that recognition. And he didn't appear in a notable role after the Constitution was adopted. So he was important as Chief Justice, but that was not on center stage. Center stage was Alexander Hamilton with his economic plan, and thus he gets on the $10 bill with the Treasury on the back. But there's nothing – there's no currency with John Jay.
Was any of it his personality? Because I get the feeling sometimes reading some of the – quotations that he had to say about ambition or behind-the-scenes stuff, that he was a man who didn't seek the spotlight. Is that accurate?
Oh, absolutely so. But that's true of many others as well. They all seem to have to be called into duty and into office. And in fact, that word duty is very important to them. And so when they are called to serve, even though it is often a sacrifice, as it was to Jay, he was willing to answer the call. His personality was also a factor in the sense that he was a reserved person. He was not outgoing. And then he angered different segments of the American society. He angered the South, we'll see when he serves as Secretary for Foreign Affairs. He's sort of leaning toward the British at a time when it's not necessarily popular to be leaning toward the British. He's suspicious of the French at maybe a time during the Revolution when it wasn't good to be of that persuasion. The French were our big allies and friends, but Jay was not too friendly toward them. So he seems to be perhaps on the wrong side often, but most people who understood him and who really knew him well would say that he was very effective, hardworking, and I would say most critical compared to perhaps all of the others. He had a moralistic air about him. He was a religious person, and so he had that personal ethic that everyone seemed to accept from him, even his enemies. Who didn't like his political stance, understood that he was a very honest and hardworking individual, and you could trust him from that perspective.
He doesn't sound like a rebel, though, with that kind of personality, you know, hardworking and kind of not seeking the limelight and conservative in many ways, soft-spoken.
That's exactly correct, and that's the family that he came from. His father was a well-to-do merchant in New York City. Jay was the third generation. His grandfather on the paternal side was forced to leave France as a Protestant. He was one of the Huguenots, and Jay never forgave France for that, or Spain, these two Bourbon Catholic countries. But he was part of that upper class in New York, colony of New York. He was trained in the law. His family owned slaves. He owned slaves eventually, not a whole lot, since he wasn't a planter. But he had some fear of the populace as a whole. And consequently, he didn't want independence, as actually most Americans didn't want independence. Very few of them did. And it's not until Thomas Paine comes along and writes Common Sense that you get
it. Stirs everybody up.
Yes, yes. I mean, you have your handful of men like Adamses and Patrick Henry who want independence in the 1760s, but that's not the case with most Americans. They're proud to be Englishmen, and Jay is so. But Jay also, from his training, has a constitutional streak about him. It's different than most others. Some will refer to the Constitution and that the British were violating the Constitution, but Jay really believed it. And you can see this later on also in his service in various areas, that he believed that the Constitution must be adhered to always, and you cannot break the Constitution. And that's the way that Jay felt about the origins of the opposition to Great Britain. But it didn't take very long before he, too, was convinced that the British were, in fact, violating the English Constitution, and thus American rights were jeopardized. And so it was easy, relatively easy, I would say, for him to make that transition from a reluctant rebel wanting reconciliation to when the British didn't favor this. And in fact, Jay wrote that we didn't declare independence from Great Britain. The king declared our independence when he declared that we were in a state of rebellion to try to protect the rights that the British ministry was jeopardizing.
What role did John Jay play in the formation of the Constitution?
The Constitution of the State of New York,
yes.
You're talking about here? Jay was in the First and Second Continental Congresses. He went home partly because he was this reluctant revolutionary. He was the drafter of a couple of the petitions to King George, but he went home and he served in the legislature. They were called provincial congresses, and then eventually they elected a provincial congress that declared itself a convention, and they wrote the New York State Constitution. It was one of the last ones to be written, the penultimate one, really. Massachusetts was last. It was written in 1777, and it was written on the fly.
This is during the war.
Yes, the British are chasing the legislature. And so, consequently, it's different than all the other constitutions before it. The other ones before are very democratic, for the most part, and they give tremendous authority to the new state assemblies. It's John Jay who is the primary author of the New York Constitution of 1777, which has a tremendous separation of powers, real separation of powers, not just lip service separation of powers. And he gives considerable authority to the governor. And the governor, through a council of revision, has a veto power over the state legislature. There's only one other convention, one other constitution that does that, and that's Massachusetts in 1780, which John Adams wrote. And Adams was fortunate to have the New York Constitution as sort of a model. And so it's these two constitutions, the New York Constitution of 1777 and the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780, that become really the foundation upon which the Constitutional Convention of 1787 builds the U.S. Constitution.
We began with that endorsement of John Jay as Minister of Foreign Affairs, and his personality and training do seem to be conducive to a good career in foreign affairs. If you're, you know, sort of steady going, but you know the legal restraints of your country, and you're perhaps tactful, more so than, say, a John Adams would be?
Well, that's quite a leap here when you're comparing John Adams to anyone. So that would be a good comparison
in terms
of anyone
of,
to John
of
Adams
tact,
as far as being a diplomat. But John Jay got good marks from his friends and questionable marks from his enemies, and particularly those enemies when they happened to be Frenchmen. They were not very friendly toward John, and they didn't think that he was performing such a good job. And that is something that would be fairly obvious from his predecessor. Jay's predecessor as Secretary for Foreign Affairs was Robert R. Livingston, who was his old college friend and bosom buddy. I mean, they made a pact that they would stay friends in 1765. No matter what they said to each other, no matter what their attitude, they would be bosom buddies for the rest of their lives. And to a certain extent, that did succeed. But Livingston was very partial to the French. Jay was not partial to the French. I don't want to say necessarily that Jay was partial to the English. If it was between the two countries, England and France, he was partial to the English. But basically, he was suspicious of everyone. And the French didn't care for that. They liked the attitude that Robert R. Livingston had, partial toward the French, and thus would be more in line to see things the way the French saw things. And that was one reason why John Jay and John Adams got along so well, because Adams did see the – Adams felt pretty much the same way as Jay, that is, quite suspicious of the French and wanting to sidle up to the English and get back with fairly normal relations after the war had ended.
What kind of role did John Jay play with the Continental Congress?
Jay was elected to the Continental Congress and was sort of a superficial character at first. But then when he came back, he had gotten more and more prominence. And he was an impressive figure when you listened to him, the knowledge that he had and the aura about him. And didn't take him very long before he was elected president of Congress.
Was he a good speaker, according to reports?
We have different reports on that. He was not the bombastical orator that some might be. He was not the kind of orator that Patrick Henry was, who was the melodic kind of a speaker who would take you to different heights. But he knew his stuff, and he was a fairly good writer, eloquent in sorts, and was able to deliver a pretty good speech. And so I think those things coupled together and his great constitutional knowledge and his writing skill, it keeps on improving his writing, and some of his biographers have said at the end he became sort of Baroque in his writing, and he understood how good a writer he was, and he went overboard then. And I'm not so sure about that. I've read virtually everything that he's written, and he's a very good writer, I would say. And he also is not opposed to editing, so he'll show his writings to different people. He wrote one time that comparing authors to parents, he said authors, like parents, are the last to see the shortcomings of their offspring. And so he saw that and had it improved by showing his writings to friends. And I think he became one of the leaders of Congress because he wasn't so provincial in favoring New York. He wasn't always taking New York's position. And New York was very important. It's where the fighting was going on for much of the early war. And so in December of 1778, he's elected president of Congress. And he writes a wonderful circular letter to the states. If you look at this, it's one of the great documents. And Emily, you mentioned before, why isn't Jay known? That is really a surprising thing because we look at some historical figures like Jefferson and Washington and their letters, whether it be the inaugural address or whether it be the farewell address. And Jay has addresses that are equally as eloquent and moving. And the presidential address, the circular to the states, is just wonderful. And yet we don't read about it. It's not in our textbooks.
Is John Jay's first foreign posting then his ministry to Spain, or is there one before that?
No, that's his first job appointed by Congress.
And you said he didn't particularly feel fondly of toward Spain and France in terms of the religious difference.
And that the feeling was mutual, apparently.
Well, Spain didn't favor the American Revolution. Spain was fearful that if the English colonies would be successful, it might stimulate the Spanish colonies to revolt as well. And so Spain wasn't going to do anything to help the Americans overtly. Spain, like France, had a big grudge against England because of what they had lost during the what was called the French and Indian War. And they were treated very harshly by the British in the Treaty of 1763. And so both France and Spain were just counting the days when they could come back and retaliate and win back some of the possessions that they had lost and regain some of the honor that they had lost as well. And so they were naturally leaning in the direction of hurting England in any way they could. And if that meant secretly supplying the American colonies, so be it. And both the French and the Spanish did that. But outwardly coming out in favor of the Americans, the Spanish weren't willing to do that. And so when Jay is appointed as our minister designate to go to Spain, he has a terrible time. He's there for almost 2 years and is not recognized. Actually, there's only one time when a government official treated him in sort of a semi-official capacity, and he was invited to attend a dinner. But all the other times, and there are multiple Spanish courts, so the Spanish court is moving around the country, and Jay is sort of left behind all the time. He has to go on his own. He's not part of the court, and so he's a little upset about that. Spain is nowhere near what it used to be also, and so he writes Jay writes about Spain. He says, "This government has little money, less wisdom, no credit, nor any right to it. They have pride without dignity, cunning without policy, nobility without honor." And so you can see he's not infatuated with the Spanish here.
And this is what one of the Spanish had to say about him in 1786. "The American, Jay, who is generally considered to possess talent and capacity enough to cover in great part a weakness natural to him, appears by consistent behavior to be a very self-centered man, which passion his wife augments because, in addition to considering herself worthy of merit and being rather vain, she likes to be catered to and even more to receive presents." The feeling was kind of mutual there, wasn't it?
Well, Sarah Livingston Jay is a beautiful woman, and she's 10 years younger than her husband. She's the daughter of William Livingston, who's the governor of New Jersey. And so this is a wonderful marriage. These two people, John and Sarah, Sally is her nickname, Jay, really love each other, truly. It's a warm relationship that's there throughout their entire marriage. And you can tell that to a certain extent because she accompanies her husband abroad. This is a very unusual thing, especially during wartime. It was a dangerous mission. They went across, and the British Navy is there. They have to get around. They have to go very far north to avoid the British Navy. And they wake up in the middle of the night once on board this ship, and they've struck something, and they don't know what it is. They go out on deck, and what it is an iceberg. They're in the middle of an iceberg field. Now, I don't know, but I think icebergs can sink ships. Am I wrong with that?
Last time I heard.
Yeah, and so here you're in a wooden ship in the middle of the night with no motor on your ship, and you have to get out of that. And so they do maneuver to get out of it. Then they're in a storm, almost like a hurricane, and they're demasted. And Jay decides to go to Martinique, and they spend several months there getting refitted. And Sally Jay is with her husband throughout all of this ordeal. Jay is at one time said the problem with Mr. Jay, his shortcoming, is Mr. Jay. And then you have Gardoqui, who just read the Spanish diplomatic figure, and he says the way to get to Jay is through his wife, that he is very jealous in a way of his wife, but very protective of his wife. And so when they dance together, when they're at a formal ball, not formal, won't be because he's not invited to that, but at a less than formal ball, they can see how much he's infatuated with his wife. And so they figure the way to get to him is to get to his wife. I don't know that that's very successful. And so that's Gardoqui's point of view, and that's the advice he gives to Flora Blanca, the foreign minister of France. But I don't think it's particularly true.
We're going to follow John Jay into positions where he becomes the Secretary for Foreign Affairs and later Chief Justice of the United States when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. As an American, I feel an interest in the dignity of my country, which renders it difficult for me to reconcile myself to the idea of the sovereign, independent states of America submitting in the persons of their ministers to be absolutely governed by the advice and opinions of the servant of another sovereign, especially in a case of such national importance. That's John Jay in 1781 accepting the role as peace commissioner working with the British, but expressing his reservations about listening to advice from the French. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is John Kaminsky, and we're talking about John Jay, the forgotten founder. So what role did he play then as peace commissioner? You said before that he actually had been a sort of reluctant rebel who had been on the side of the British in many ways. So what kind of role does he play now as peace commissioner?
He arrives in Paris from Madrid, and he's the only peace commissioner that's available. Henry Lawrence has been named. He was former president of Congress, was captured when he was coming over. So he's in the Tower of London. John Adams is in the Netherlands trying to obtain a loan for the United States. And Benjamin Franklin is quite sick with the gout and with kidney stones and unable to attend the diplomatic sessions that are just beginning. Jefferson gets appointed but never leaves the United States for the purpose of being on the peace commission. So it's John Jay alone, and he's dealing with the British diplomat, the British commissioners, and Jay is insistent that their instructions, the British commissioners' instructions, say that they are to negotiate with the independent United States of America, not with the 13 rebellious colonies. And so this is a difficult point that goes on for well over a month. And the American diplomats are very pleased with this. Now, later historians question whether the obstinacy of Jay, and he was an obstinate man, to be sure, perhaps cost an opportunity to get Canada. That is, Franklin throws out the initiative, maybe we can get back together, Britain and the United States, if we have friendly relations, and we'll jettison the French afterwards. But you've got to give us certain things, some candy here. You got to give us some prizes, among which would be Canada. Now, the British want that division between the United States and France later on, but they're not willing to give up Canada, I think. And in fact, what happens very shortly, they get the better hand in Gibraltar. And when Gibraltar is saved, is not going to be captured by the Spanish, then the British are negotiating from a stronger point of view. But throughout the negotiations, Jay is the prominent of the three men, Franklin, Adams, and Jay. And in fact, there's an interesting point that once when they were going into a dinner, Madame Vergen, the wife of the foreign secretary of France, is accompanied by John Adams. They always exchange partners. You don't go in with your wife. You exchange. And Madame Vergen says satirically to John Adams, Mr. Adams, you are the Washington of diplomacy. And they all sort of chuckled, the French. They understood how silly that was. Adams took it very seriously. And later on, after the negotiations are all over, Adams says to of Jay, he is the Washington of diplomacy. And he doesn't mean it satirically. He means it very wholeheartedly, that Jay was the most important member of the American negotiating team. And what they got was astonishing. Everybody, the French and Congress, couldn't believe how successful that negotiation was, that they had gotten as their boundary Canada on the north, the Mississippi on the west, and the Spanish on the south in Florida. So it was a very, very successful negotiations.
So why wouldn't Jay continue in his career as, say, a foreign minister?
Because he was done. He he didn't want to serve in public office. And he says this repeatedly. And it's time now for him to go home. Congress has indicated that he's not going to be the minister to Great Britain. And so that's fine with him. He doesn't want the job. He wants to go home and help his family. His father is older now and needs assistance. He has a brother who's blind. He has two children of his own. And so he would like to go home and resume his legal career. That's what really made him comfortable. He felt his training was in the law, and that's what he wanted to be, not a diplomat. And so when the opportunity came for him to come home, he readily took it and came back. Unfortunately for him, when he landed in America, he found that Congress had appointed him Secretary for Foreign Affairs. So he is now Secretary of State for the United States.
And did he even have the option of turning that down?
Probably not. Yeah. He was the most experienced American diplomat. I mean, he had negotiated with the French. He was over there, negotiated with the Spanish, and negotiated with the English. So he was the right man for the job. Everyone realized that. And there was universal applause with the appointment. And he played hard to get. He didn't just say, okay, I'll do this. He said, first of all, Congress has to stop its meandering around the country and establish a permanent capital, which is New York City, which was his home. So he wouldn't have to be traveling away from home. And also he demanded certain things. He demanded that all foreign communications would have to go through his office and that there would be translation of every foreign document and that all of the state laws would be sent in to the Congress so that those in Congress and particularly the Foreign Office would understand what was going on domestically because that had such an impact in foreign affairs. And so he jumped into this. He understood how important it was. He would prefer not to have been. He chastised a number of people for quitting office. And when he was put in that situation, he felt he couldn't turn it down.
And what form of government are we talking about now? This is pre-Articles of Confederation?
No, this is now the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation were drafted in 1777. They went out to the states in November of 1777, and it took 3.5 years to ratify them. Maryland was the last to ratify on March 1st of 1781. Now this is 1784, that 3 years later, that Jay is coming back. And so what we've seen is a transformation of the Continental Congress and the Confederation Congress. It used to be that the members of Congress served in all the key positions. Now it's such an onerous job that it's there. They realize this, that they create departments. And so there are various departments. There's a post office department. There's a finance department. And Robert Morris was the superintendent of finance. There's a war department. And then there's the foreign affairs department. And that's the department that Jay was asked to lead.
And who's running the show right now? I mean, if you had to look at the power structure in terms of who is the most powerful, second, third, and so on, who's running it, who's making the decisions, and where does John Jay fit in that?
There's a president of Congress, but the president of Congress really isn't running the show. The president of Congress is more or less the equivalent of the speaker of the House of Representatives. And so the person running the show was Robert Morris as superintendent of finance. This is typical. The prime minister of Great Britain is usually the first lord of the treasury. But the problem with Morris was he was so demanding. And if he didn't get his way, he would threaten to resign. And Congress was very frightened of him. They thought he wanted to be emperor of the United States. And so when one time he threatened to resign, they said, fine, resign. And he did. And so what Jay found was when he became Secretary for Foreign Affairs, he stepped into that vacuum. And he became the de facto prime minister of the United States. So for the next 5 years, he serves in that capacity. He's the most important figure, public figure, let me put it that way. It's pretty hard to supplant George Washington from being the most important figure, but he's not in government. He's retired and gone home. But Jay is the most important public figure and is, as I say, everyone recognizes him to be prime minister of the United States.
Well, he has this experience with the Continental Congress, having been president of it. So in these kind of formative years before the Constitution is ratified, what is Jay's thinking about sort of the balance of the power, where the Congress should fit in, where the other branches of government might play one against the other?
It's a fairly common thing, I believe, that the men who served high in office, in civilian office, and the men who served high in a military capacity, these men become nationalists. They see how the weaknesses of Congress as the Second Continental Congress and then as the Confederation Congress, their weaknesses really created tremendous difficulties for the country in dealing with diplomatic issues, military issues, and interstate issues, the federal-state relationship. All these were suspect because of the federal-state relationship. And you have a number of individuals, Madison and Jefferson. This is sort of astonishing. These men believe that the Confederation Congress has implied powers and that they ought to exercise those implied powers. Jay is a little bit more constitutional than these other two. He understands Article 2 of the Articles of Confederation, which says that the states retain their sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and Congress has only those powers that are expressly delegated to it. Yet Madison and Jefferson believe there are implied powers, even though the words are right there, that there are no implied powers. But they are looking at the law of nations, and that when you give a government power to declare war and power to borrow money, you must give it power also to collect money and to raise an army. Jefferson says it's a very simple matter. He's now off in Europe, in France, taking over for Franklin. He says all the Congress should do is if a state won't pay its taxes to Congress, just send a frigate and blockade the state. Well, he's talking about potential civil war here.
Yes.
But he's also not in tune with reality in that Congress in 1786 sold its last frigate. There's no navy. And so there is no ship to send to recalcitrant states. So Jay is more diplomatic in that sense. He understands the kind of role he must play with the states. And he is a staunch nationalist and works very hard with Washington to get Washington to come out of retirement, to help the country. He writes to Washington like no one else could write to Washington. After all, Jay is the top figure in government and is the prime minister, not only in everybody else's eyes, but in his own eyes. And he understands how important Washington is. And so it's critical for these men to obtain fame. That's is a manifestation that they've been good citizens. Washington obtained his fame and didn't want to risk that again. He retired, never served in government again. Jay wrote to him and said, you must leave your temple of fame, that is Mount Vernon, and come and help us. We need you. We have to have you to come and strengthen this central government. And so he was critical in that capacity.
I was startled to see, reading about John Jay, that he's credited as being one of the co-authors of the Federalist Papers, because I've really only seen Hamilton and Madison listed as the authors for the most part. What role did he play in it?
It's hard to say how the Federalist Papers began. Most people give Hamilton credit for starting the Federalist Papers, and he brought in John Jay. I'm not sure if that's correct. There's a good chance, I would say, that the two men working together, Hamilton and Jay, came up with the idea for the Federalist Papers. But these were the two authors, the only two authors. And Hamilton wrote number one, which was an introduction to maybe what would amount to 26 essays or so. There were eventually 85 essays, but they were anticipating a much smaller number. And then the next four were written by Jay. Jay then got sick, and he couldn't contribute anymore. And it was at that point that Hamilton looked for a replacement, and he tried different people. And Madison was the one he selected. Madison was obviously had the writing ability to do this. And so a number of other people were tried and not selected. A number of other people were mentioned, Gouverneur Morris and Rufus King, but Hamilton didn't think that much of their writing ability compared to Madison. And they thought, let's try to do this on our own. And Jay then contributes later on to number 64. So he writes number 2, 3, 4, 5, and number 64 when he's better health. Number 64 has to do with treaty writing and the powers of the Senate. And so you can see that Jay was particularly well suited for that, since he had been Secretary for Foreign Affairs for 5 years. So he knew about treaty writing. And so he writes these five numbers. Coincidentally here, there's only four of the original manuscript that survive of the 85 numbers. And those four are John Jay. And there are no originals of Madison or Hamilton. And I think that that's the case, because if you look at those four original manuscripts in Jay's handwriting, they're simply a mess. And I think they were so worked over that Jay felt that the printer probably could not do a good job of copying them. So I suspect he wrote a clean copy himself, sent that clean copy to the printer, who then destroyed that copy. But Jay was left with his original manuscript. And so that's what has come down to us.
And the Federalist Papers are expressions of American political philosophy that were influential, finally, in the Constitution. Would that be their main role, do you think?
Yes, yes. I often will ask teachers who wrote the Federalist Papers, and they'll say Hamilton. I'd say no. They'll say Madison. I'll say no. And they're getting a little perplexed. And then they say Jay, and I say no. And they don't know, am I crazy or what? Mm-hmm. But I say to them that the Federalist Papers were written by Publius. That is, that's the pseudonym that they chose to use. And so there was probably no Federalist in the country who opposed the Constitution more than Alexander Hamilton. And yet he's saying wonderful things about the Constitution in the Federalist Papers. This is a political series, political document, trying to get New Yorkers to elect Federalists, supporters of the Constitution, to the New York Ratifying Convention. And it totally fails. They elect 2/3 of their members are anti-Federalists. And so for its immediate purpose, it was a failure. But in a broader sense, it laid out the best arguments in favor of the Constitution. And this was particularly useful later on under the Constitution. And so the Supreme Court regularly uses the Federalist Papers today as one of the telling documents of how to interpret the Constitution from the point of view of the original framers. And so Jay wrote five of those. And the first four that he wrote, numbers 2 through 5, are just sort of amazing. You have that great ability to write that's there, but you also have the ability the tendency, which Jay doesn't have, of alienating people. That is, he alienates the anti-Federalists, because he says in these first four numbers that he writes that there's a whole group of people out there who want separate confederacies, who want to break up the Union. He's saying that if you don't favor the Constitution, you want separate confederacies. Maybe you want to start a Southern Confederacy like Patrick Henry. Now, none of that is true. And yet this alienates – you can see how it would alienate the opposers of the Constitution if they're labeled as disunion advocates, because they're not. And so Jay writes what a wonderful thing union is, how important it is. He writes also what a God-given gift it's been that the American people are so unified, and we're given this wonderful land, that the people were made for the land for the people. It's a wonderful statement that Jay writes in his very beginning. In his first number, the Federalist Papers, number 2 it is, Jay says, what a remarkable thing that we've been given this fertile country that is surrounded by wonderful rivers, great rivers that tie us together. But then he looks at the people and how this people were made for this country as well.
Saying, with equal pleasure, I have as often taken notice that Providence has been pleased to give this one connected country to one united people, a people descended from the same ancestors, speaking the same language, professing the same religion, attached to the same principles of government, very similar in their manners and customs, and who, by their joint counsels, arms, and efforts, fighting side by side throughout a long and bloody war, have nobly established their general liberty and independence. This country and this people seem to have been made for each other, and it appears as if it was the design of Providence that an inheritance so proper and convenient for a band of brethren, united to each other by the strongest ties, should never be split into a number of unsocial, jealous, and alien sovereignties.
The thoughts of John Jay. We are going to look at what position he held under President George Washington when we return in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is John Kaminsky, and we are talking about John Jay, the forgotten founding father. We've gotten him through the sort of early days of the Revolution and also the Continental Congress, the establishment of Federalist Papers and other things as they're trying to work out the Constitution. What kind of role does he play once George Washington comes to power?
Well, he's critical. I'd like to say he's the James Madison of New York. And so Washington understands how critical it is to get him into the government. And so he asks him secretly, Madison tells us this, that you could have anything you want. What is the position that you would like? Would you like to continue as Secretary of State? And that's going to be a larger job because it's going to include both foreign affairs but also domestic affairs. And Jay was doing a lot of that as Secretary for Foreign Affairs under the Confederation. But his real love was the law. And he said to Washington that he would like to be Chief Justice. He was the first Chief Justice of New York. He could have been Governor of New York, but he chose not to take that role, chose to be Chief Justice, and he chooses that for the new government.
So he's the first Chief Justice of the United States?
That's correct.
It's interesting because he doesn't seem to have that much fame as the first Chief Justice. Is that because there weren't any critical cases that came before him, or is it just because we don't know enough?
Yes, to both of those. It's a combination of things. But obviously our first great Chief Justice that we all point to is John Marshall.
Right.
But what happens is Jay sort of preempts Marshall, but he does it in a sort of different way that doesn't bring notoriety to himself, as John Marshall does. I like to say with John Marshall, using the vernacular, he makes a federal case out of everything. and what I mean by that is he takes incidental cases that are insignificant and he uses them, takes the opportunity to state a profound federal position against the states. And so he does that. Jay will not do that kind of thing. And in fact, he does just the opposite from the very beginning. Here's a court that is going to work very hard. It has two sessions in February and August, and then it rides the circuit. There is no circuit court system. That is, no courts per se, but there's a district judge in every state and also in Maine and Kentucky. And then there are six justices of the Supreme Court, not seven but six. And there are three circuits, the Northern Circuit, that is New York through Maine, a Middle Circuit, New Jersey through Virginia, and a Southern Circuit, the Carolinas and Georgia. And the two Supreme Court justices ride with a district judge in each state, and that's the makeups, the circuit court. And so you have a number of cases that become very prominent at both the Supreme Court level and also at the circuit court level, and I'll mention two of them. The first is Chisholm versus Georgia. This is a case where there's a provision in Article 3 of the Constitution that gives the original jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has, in addition to that, all other appellate jurisdiction. And so one of the original jurisdictions of the Supreme Court is between a state and citizens of another state or foreign citizens. Throughout the entire ratification debate, that including John Jay, says that allows the United States to sue, or it allows a state, that is, to sue an individual in another state or to sue a foreigner. But now in this particular case, a citizen of another state sues Georgia, and Jay says that's acceptable. That gets rid of sovereign immunity. States were not allowed to be sued before against their own wishes. But now Jay says that, yes, a state can be sued, and Georgia won't even defend itself. Eventually what happens is Georgia loses this case. But there's such an outcry against what Jay has done that the Congress proposes the 11th Amendment to the Constitution, which says that states cannot be sued. And it's passed immediately by the states. So the 11th Amendment is a direct outgrowth of Chisholm versus Georgia, which Jay decided. Then there's another case that comes up under a law called the Invalid Pension Act of 1792. And this act does exactly what it says. It's going to give pensions to soldiers that were wounded during the Revolution. The act provides that the circuit judges, that means the two Supreme Court justices and the district judge, they will be the persons to receive the pension applications. And they will rule on these and then submit them to Congress. The Senate can reject them, and the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of War, can reject them. And so it's Jay sitting for the Northern Circuit who says, we haven't had a case, but we can't sit as judges doing this. But it's James Wilson and John Blair, two justices of the Supreme Court. In the Middle Circuit, they write to President Washington, and they say, this law is unconstitutional. And if we get a case, we're going to if we get an application, we will say that this law is unconstitutional. And so you better get this changed. The Attorney General of the United States wants to bring this before the Supreme Court ex parte, that is without a case. Supreme Court says, no, this is John Jay. And they get a case then, William Heyburn in Pennsylvania. And so he asks for a pension. And so what does the Supreme Court do? Now, if it were Marshall, he would make a bold statement. But that's not what John Jay does. John Jay says, we will take this under advisement at our next session. This is a gentlemanly way, a very mild way of saying, very diplomatic way of saying, this is an unconstitutional law. Congress, you better change it. And they do change the law. And so the Supreme Court could have declared this the first law, congressional law, that was unconstitutional, would have been given great notoriety, as Marbury versus Madison was given great notoriety. But Jay didn't operate that way. He would work behind the scenes, was better for him. And so he did that. Now, one other thing that Jay did was when the war is heating up in Europe, Washington drafts a proclamation of neutrality. Jefferson takes that to the Supreme Court and asks Jay for a judgment on it in advance of a case. And Jay says no. The Supreme Court is the court of last resorts and cannot be, like the courts in England, giving advice to the president or to the Congress. And so it stays out. It doesn't decide the proclamation of neutrality. Now, the latest scholarship on that, William Castro has come out and said he didn't want to do that because he would have to say it was unconstitutional in his judgment. It interfered with the Congress's right to declare war. The fact is the president declaring peace was interfering with the Congress's right to declare war.
So John Jay seems fairly comfortable in his role as Chief Justice. Why did he go back into politics, run for the governorship of New York?
He felt that he wasn't doing enough and that there weren't that many cases coming before the Supreme Court. And most of all, he hated riding the circuit. He thought it was terrible. He thought it didn't give the appropriate dignity to the Supreme Court. And so when he was approached, would you run for the governorship of New York in 1792? He did. He didn't run. He stood.
Stood for election.
Right. He doesn't campaign. And he wins, really. But there were some discrepancies in four counties. Three of them were pretty small counties that were supporters of George Clinton. The last county was a large county and supported him. All counties were thrown out. Their ballots were thrown out. And George Clinton was reelected in 1792. And Jay was left out. It could have tore the state apart. But Jay sort of calmed down his wife. His wife was very ambitious for him and said, you know, all this is going to be over in a relatively short time, and we're going to go to eternity, and I will know that I did the right thing here on earth. And so he does not get elected governor in 1792, but that's going to change in 1795.
What's he doing in between?
He continues to be Chief Justice. He gives his charges to the grand juries as he's going around. They're wonderful statements, very patriotic statements. And what he does, it's critical. There's a paradigm switch that takes place in America at this time. Up until this time, starting from the navigation laws in the 1670s, Americans smuggled. They avoided paying taxes. And this was a patriotic thing to do, to not pay the English customs duties on things if you can get away with it. And so now this is a different ballgame. And what Jay says in the charge to the grand juries is you folks, you men, must indict your neighbors when they're smuggling. They're no longer patriots. They are criminals. And if you don't indict them, then we're going to have to pay more taxes, everybody else. And then he says also, over and above the merchants who traditionally were smugglers, you have to watch government officials, these officials who often the colonial officials would turn their heads and allow smuggling. That's not to happen in this new government. And if they violate the law, they must be indicted also. So being fairly strict in the interpretation of the law. It's interesting to see that Hamilton, writing to the customs collector in Providence, says, allow a little bit of smuggling to take place. Let's not get them so angry with us. But eventually what happens is the war in Europe is raging. Both Britain and the French are taking advantage of American merchantmen. And Washington, to avoid war, sends Jay to England to negotiate a treaty. He understands he's going over there with virtually no leverage whatsoever. And he comes back with really only one accomplishment, and that is he has gotten the British to agree to leave the Northwest Post, which they were supposed to leave after the end of the Revolution. And this was very embarrassing for Jay. Jay is a real believer in honor, and this has haunted him ever since the days when he was Secretary for Foreign Affairs. He couldn't get the British out of those Northwest Posts. He accomplished it here, but he got nothing else from the British, and this treaty was really condemned pretty much, mainly in the South, but all over the country. Jay was burned in effigy, as was Alexander Hamilton, hanged in effigy as well. And so it was not a good thing for him. But before it became known, he comes back from the diplomatic mission in England and finds out he was elected governor of the state of New York. And so he becomes governor.
He also gets his name attached to that treaty, right?
He does.
It's about
he
the
does.
Only thing where the John Jay name seems to stick.
That's right.
To
and
it.
It's not smiled upon as one of the great treaties, although it did keep the United States out of war. And that was a major accomplishment at the time.
Did he do anything significant as governor of New York?
Not a whole lot. Things were going along fairly smoothly. And in fact, he had to raise taxes, which was not a good thing, didn't make him popular. But the one thing that he did do was he signed a bill for the emancipation of the slaves, gradual emancipation, that had been proposed in 1785. It was a terrible bill. This was a gradual process of emancipation. That is, when a child is born to a slave woman, that child will be free. In New York, when they become an adult. And that means 25 and 28 years old. But that original act in 1785 called for an apartheid society, that blacks who had been black men who could vote before if they were free could not vote any longer. And there was going to be total discrimination against them. And that bill was repealed, vetoed, I should say. And it took another 14 years before you get another gradual emancipation bill that is passed, and Jay is the one who signs that. Jay was the first president of the New York Abolition Society, established in 1785, 1786. Although it's a little hard to understand sometimes, he owned slaves. But all abolitionists were not necessarily free of being racist, and all abolitionists did not believe that blacks should have all the civil and political rights that whites had. But they were opposed to slavery as a condition, and Jay was a staunch advocate against slavery.
John Kaminsky, thanks for joining us for this hour and filling us in on the forgotten founder, John Jay. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.